Dargrave Publishing presents The Heartland Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Economics and Business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101 for Summer Semester 2014. Lecture 10, delivered on July 8, 2014. The title of this lecture is Risk and Uncertainty.
Tonight, Risk and Uncertainty in Economics. Before I get to that subject, however, I do want to make a few last comments on factor markets, specifically on the labor market, but I'm going to make a few more general comments. Remember that the factors of production are land, labor, human capital, physical capital, and equity. Equity comes in two forms, sweat equity and investment equity. The thing of it is that it's easy to just say land, but obviously there are different types of land. There's land that is better for some things than for other things. Just like there is physical capital encompasses so many different kinds of capital, trucks, computers, staples, buildings, they're all physical capital and they all have their own markets. And so there's not just a homogeneous physical capital market any more than there is a homogeneous human capital market. Labor, remember, technically is just flat, plain old donkey work. You can't make much as a laborer except subsistence wage because everyone in the world can be a subsistence wage laborer. The trick is to find yourself a skill or a skill set that is going to differentiate you. You are in monopolistic competition. Your job, and this is something when I go through resumes, the whole job search thing with the freshman business students at Illinois State University, you are selling yourself. Everything you're doing here is for the purpose of becoming something different from everyone else who's looking for a job. And we kind of get a little rough, the career services director and I, we get together and we're talking to these students and we say this, look, when you apply for that job, you're in your senior year, you apply for that job, well, you know what? Your college degree doesn't mean a thing. And they look very shocked. And you mean I went wasting my time? No. No. When I say it doesn't mean a thing is that the other 200 applicants for this job that you want, they've got the same college degree. No matter what you're doing, you're probably going to have others who can do the same thing. That's why you have to do other things besides just get a college degree. You have to get a good GPA. That's fine. But you also have to involve yourself in the life of the school, in activities, in the business fraternities that we have, in community service work. Having a job, that's what distinguishes you so that you are not exactly like the other 199 people who are applying for the job. In other words, everything that you're doing, being here in this class with an incredible instructor like me and everything else, okay, all that kind of stuff is to the purpose of making you not have be on just this labor supply curve where there are 6 billion people on it too. You'll be on it, but what you want to do is also be on a labor supply curve that has a little slope to it. Because what that means is that you have a skill set. If they hire one person, then the next person they hire they'll have to pay more to because there is not an infinite supply of these skilled workers. And the more education you get, the more skill sets that you can put on your resume, the more you can talk about how I am different, the steeper the labor supply curve, the marginal labor supply curve you're on. So by the time you get out of college, you would like to be on a really steep labor supply curve like that. Now let's talk about the wage market. Woman, are you in college for the duration of a 4-year degree?
I assume so.
You assume so. That's what your plan is. Don't worry, your plans will be destroyed and all that, but let's hold on to that for a little bit here, okay? Now, what major did you have?
My major?
Yeah. Whatever, fine. You'll actually live comfortably. What would you anticipate your starting salary would be? You got a ballpark? You're going to get your CPA.
If I get my CPA, then it would be a bump up, but like right out.
Right out. Yeah. What do you think? I'd and where you go to. Or if you go to one of those hot places up in Chicago and all that. Realistically, I would put it at your stage maybe about 45. Okay? Trust me. But you got to be a go-getter. You can't just say, okay, I'll work in Peoria. You got to want it. But you could. Okay, now the point there being that, look, I've had students with exactly identical degrees. Identical. GPAs very similar to each other coming out. Same level of student involvement, community service, business fraternity. And you'll have one come out, and I'll give you some actual numbers from the graduates in May. One came out at 38, another came out at 70. Same everything about them. So how does that happen? Well, maybe connections, maybe go-getterness or whatever about that. But there are other factors involved. Let's talk about some low-end wages. Walmart pays minimum wage. Any of you work at Walmart? You should. It's great work. Of course. Are you a greeter?
No. Cashier.
If you're not a greeter, anyway. No, okay. Walmart. Approximately minimum wage is where they start. You're probably making a little more than that by now. But okay, let's talk minimum wage. What's the minimum wage? About $8.25. Okay. Now, you can work at Walmart at $8.25. You can start there. Do you know what the starting wage is at Costco, another big box retailer, virtually identical in business to Walmart? What is it?
It's higher, a lot higher.
$15 an hour, just to start. Same kinds of people, same work, same level of education, and yet you will be paid more at Costco. Now, what does that say about the labor market? Is there some kind of a weird inefficiency? Is Walmart trying to screw workers? Or is Costco stupid and they're just paying hillbillies too much? It's a dilemma, and we ask this question a lot, and I ask it of myself. How could this person have gotten started out 38, and this person, it wasn't 70, it was close to 70. How does that happen? Okay, here's the deal. We have two theories. One is this. Okay, you pay more for better workers. That seems reasonable, but that can't be what's going on with Walmart, Costco. That can't be the experience I'm seeing with students who are coming out in the 30s versus students who are coming out in the 50s and 60s with their salaries. That brings us to another theory called the efficiency wage theory, which seems to actually be the one that's playing. It has to do with the company's business model. And we have found that there are companies that the business model encompasses this idea. If you pay workers more, they will be better workers. If you pay workers less, they will be less desirable workers. Now, we have some evidence of this, but there's a limit on it. We find that with workers up to a total annual salary of about $75,000, the more you pay them, the more productive they are. We've done a lot of research, and I've got a video that you could watch on YouTube that's that summarizes the research. Up to $75,000, the more you pay the worker, the better the worker gets. That would explain Walmart versus Costco. But then an interesting thing takes over. Above $75,000 a year or so, paying a worker more gets no more productivity. No more. Paying a CEO $50 million a year, paying a coach or a player that much money, gets no more productivity out of those people. That means that there is actually both models are in play. Up to a certain salary, about 75, and there are arguments, maybe it's a little higher than that. Paying workers more, you actually get them to work better. They will create more. They will be much more productive. But if you think that you can get more productivity out of workers above by paying them more after they've topped out at about 75, ain't going to happen. It just is not going to happen. Study after study has indicated the same thing. You pay these people millions of dollars to be CEOs and executives of these corporations, it's not doing anything. You're not getting any more from them if you'd paid them $75,000, $100,000 a year. But here's what we do know. After you get to a certain threshold, and again, there's argument. Is it $75,000, $85,000, $100,000? After you get to a certain threshold, there is a way to get more productivity out of workers, but it isn't pay. It's freedom. It's creativity. You leave the workers alone. You give them autonomy in their creative actions. You respect them. You give them titles. You give them days when they can do just the kind of stuff they think the company would benefit from. You get more creativity out of them without paying them another damn dime. So there is a lesson in the labor markets, is that eventually we figure out that most people, once they get to a certain salary, they've got all the things they need, food, shelter, toys, but after that, it doesn't seem to make them any more productive if you hold a carrot. Well, if you do more for us, we'll bring your salary up to 150. If you do more for us, we'll bring your salary up to 300,000. It doesn't work. Well, we see these people get more productive, but the reason they get more productive is not because they're being paid more. It's because at those higher levels of authority, they have more freedom to act on their own in decision-making. That's what's causing their greater productivity, not those ridiculous wages they're paid. I know a person, right, told me at the end of last year, she got her annual bonus. She's an executive at a company here in town. Her annual bonus last year was close to twice my salary as a college professor, just an annual bonus. Does that mean that she's a more productive worker? No, she's an idiot. She needs to die. Well, that's going to be edited out of this conversation. Let me get off that subject, but there's a lesson for you to learn, and I will, if you take me for courses at the university, you're going to hear me emphasize these things, that it's not always about more pay. It's about more productivity. And we find that that is a much more complicated thing than just offering more money to people. And so remember that when you people become managers, and every one of you, and God help us, is going to be a manager. It's not about what you pay them. It's about how much you respect them, how much you respect what they can do for your company. Let me get on to this subject of risk and uncertainty here. Interestingly enough, when I was in my learning years at the Ohio State University in economics, risk and uncertainty were never talked about. It was only when I began to specialize in finance that I was really exposed to the concept of risk as a driving factor in decision making. They just didn't talk about it. Ohio State was extreme conservative economics, right-wing economics. And everything is certain in their world. Well, this leads to this leads to this. There's no nuance. There's no place for uncertainty. We know what's going to happen if you do this. If you raise the minimum wage, it's going to create unemployment. If you elect this man as president, this liberal as president, we'll have the apocalypse tomorrow. But realistically, when I got into finance, I began to find out, oh my God, there's this huge factor no one ever talked about, even in the PhD level, in economics, risk. Now, I'm going to bring up something here. I'm going to tell you something. You're going to die someday. It's going to hurt like hell, probably. It could be tomorrow or tonight or in 50 years. You know. But I'd watch out tonight, you know, just be on the safe side. Your life is going in according to a plan. You're going to get through college, and then you're going to get one of those good jobs, and you're going to be on this path of great income. Okay, but you are going to get cancer, prostate cancer. You will scare children with that lump, okay, until they remove it. And then girls won't matter to you no more, okay? Just wanted to let you know. But I don't know when that's going to happen. Good probability that you will have three marriages and 2.5 kids. No, it was actually down the middle. So the kid isn't really half slow. The kid is half fast. The hell with you. Follow me on this. You see, so much of our decision-making is under uncertainty. We talk about rational decision-making. Everyone is rational. That's true. But we are rational within bounds because there is a lot that we don't know about how things are going to come out. When we buy something that is good, have you ever bought something you thought was going to be really good and it turned out to suck really badly? I've done that. Or I thought I was going to have just a wonderful time. Some months back, I was headed back from Chicago. I stopped and I got myself 10 White Castle cheeseburgers, extra onions, and jalapeno peppers. I thought this is going to be the greatest thing in the world, but it wasn't. Not a couple hours later. There's that old country and western song, and the thunder rolls. Well, the lightning strikes too, okay? Call it, woman. Well, spank me Jesus. She's a regular, incredible person, okay? I throw this coin up in the air 10 times, and it comes up heads 10 times. What's the probability that it'll come up heads on the next throw?
50%.
Bingo. Because they're independent throws. Nothing about the past matters. In most probabilistic environments, the past is eaten away, and all that matters is the current event. There is pure uncertainty involved in this. So what does that have to do with economics? This, we're rational, but we'll remember that bounded rationality. And one of the binding features of it is the uncertainty that we have. When you're here in this school, you don't know whether what you are getting your degree in is going to actually pay you very well. I've seen it happen before. Right now, the hot trends are healthcare and special education. And both of those, that sounds just like what happened when the hot trend was all of the computer science stuff in the 1990s. That's the wave of the future. There will be a million computers in every company and all that. And now it's the future is healthcare. There will be all these old people trying to stay alive and all these special needs kids with everything from autism to diarrhea of the brain. Okay, good. But I am betting you that it will be exactly the same trajectory. The uncertainty we have can't be fixed. So how do we deal with that uncertainty? I'm going to show you. This is your life on the board. Specifically, your cost of health care, what on an annual basis through your life. You start out your life, you were pretty sickly when you were born. I mean, we talked about putting you out on the rocks, but, you know, we thought maybe there's a place for you somewhere. So we paid the high health care costs, and you did get healthier over your first year or so of life. Things went better, and then you had that little demon possession. The priest cost a lot of money, but we paid it. And then there was that incident where you fell off the stairs. Fell off. I mean, I didn't know I was going to trip you and you'd go like that. But then you're in your early years. You got your usual childhood diseases and the vomiting and the diarrhea. But you get through that, and then you're 8 years old. You break your arm. And then you break your other arm. Then you break your leg. Anyway, and then you have a couple of years when things are going good. And then you get into your teen years. Damn, that acne was bad. And then settle down a little bit. And then you have that bout with split multiple personalities. We got through that. We got rid of the one that was actually kind of pleasant to live with. But then we get you into your later teen years. And your healthcare costs actually begin to decline. Do any of you remember being sicker as a kid than you've been in the last few years? It's actually kind of cool. You develop herd immunities as you go forward. And you'll be in these great years where you actually, geez, I remember I used to barf my brains out. Some of those were pretty rough sessions and the diarrhea and all that kind of stuff where you just felt wretched. And you're getting better. I mean, you're still going to have illnesses, but in your 20s, you're in your really healthy years, and you feel good about yourself and all that, except for you got that venereal disease from that girl, but that was your fault. And then you got your health care costs. You were doing some sports stuff, ultimate frisbee, and that frisbee hit you. I mean, it did take a plastic surgery to get it out of your face, but, and then you get into your 30s, you get a little paunch on you, and you try to do some sports to get yourself firmed back up, and that doesn't work out, rotator cuff injury, torn ass muscle, and then you get up to about 40, your cholesterol is getting bad, so you have to take cholesterol medicine all the time, then the diabetes sets in. And then you have your first heart attack. You get over that. And then there's the prostate cancer and that implant they had to give you. And then there's another cancer scare. And then you did that plastic surgery so that you wouldn't look like a gargoyle. Then there's more blood sugar medicine, more cholesterol, heart disease medicine. As you're going into your 60s, cancer, heart attack again. By the time you're in your 80s, you're okay as long as no one trips over your plug, and then you die. Your life. Here's your income path. We'll kind of ignore this part. But you're making enough. Going up. Oh, my. There's a point where your health care costs overrun your income. You're done. Game over. You have hit what we call gambler's ruin. You have essentially had an uncertain event that you don't know when it would happen overwhelm your ability to pay it with your income. Okay, well, let's move on. I mean, let's do someone else. You, woman, this is your life. You start out healthy, and you're really good, well off, but you do have some pretty severe problems right off the bat, but you get through them. Your childhood illnesses come at slightly different times than the other fellows, and you're a quieter, calmer kind of person, although then you get that big accident. You got run over by the truck. It didn't really change. It kind of changed you. You were bitchy ever after that, but your health care costs have their own movements up and down. But you then hit diabetes. You live into your 40s, and then you have breast cancer. You're still healthy. Cholesterol begins to kick in. Iron deficiencies, osteoporosis. But you keep living. You have dialysis machine, but you keep alive. Melanoma, big nodules on your head. And then you flatline. Here's the interesting thing, though. Now, you are paid a lower wage than he is, so you're going to hit gambler's ruin there. But here's an interesting thing about the way the universe works. This is true of healthcare costs. This is true of many things that seem to have nothing whatsoever to do with each other. Is that these random ups and downs of you and you are not perfectly correlated, which means that they actually partially cancel each other out. If I put in a third person and a fourth person and a fifth person, these healthcare costs of people in a cohort group tend over a period, over even 1,000 people, 5,000 people, they will cancel each other out so much that by the time I've put them all together and talk about an overall average healthcare cost per person in the risk pool, it will be a smooth, predictable line, curve, I should say. And then if I have people of different age cohorts in it, put them into this risk pool too, I get enough people of different ages with non-perfectly correlated healthcare costs. Eventually what happens is I have a perfectly flat, smooth line that I can predict. The individuals are completely uncertain. I don't know when you're going to get prostate cancer. I don't know when you're going to get those nodules on your head. But I do know that if I put all of you together, I don't need to know. Because I can predict the exact, almost down to the penny. Well, not quite that good. Down to the dollar, how much it's going to cost per year to insure the pool. So if I'm an insurance company, a healthcare insurance company, all I have to do is get enough people of enough different ages with enough different risk factors, and then I know how much I'm going to pay out every year. It works that way. The same thing is true when I teach about stock markets. I tell my students, look, you invest in one stock, you're the stupidest ass on earth. You listen to the programs, well, I think we should put some money, you should invest in this stock. You're dumb as hell, and you deserve to lose your money. Because essentially, when you buy one stock, you're buying extreme noise that no market's ever going to reward you for. If you buy 30, 50, 100 stocks, or if you buy an index that invests in that, then all of those random, unpredictable movements of each individual stock cancel each other out, and you've got a hum of risk. Just predictable. You get 100 stocks in a portfolio, I can tell you what it's going to do over 10, 15 years. But if you buy one stock, I don't care how safe it is, you probably are going to lose your ass before you gain money. That's how it works. So you see, what we're talking about here is risk indemnification. In other words, insurance. As long as you have enough different people in a pool, you can pretty much predict the cost of the entire pool with almost certainty. So an insurance company, it's not really in so much the business of risk as it is in making sure that it's got enough people, and then it can just charge what it pretty much is sure is going to be the cost, and then add a pad to it to make a profit in this. And then you're all good. You're all good. Two years ago, I took my finance students up to one of the big, huge international insurance companies in Chicago. It's not actually an insurance company. It's a reinsurance company. They insure the insanely large stuff all over the world. And that was at the time that the Fukushima reactor had cooked out in Japan. You know, that tsunami came in, the reactor went cuckoo and all of that. And so one of my students, I think he was kind of a smartass, said, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't your company the lead insurer for Fukushima? And the guy, this risk manager, looked at him like, you toad. And he was nice, though. He said, oh, yeah, we got killed on that one. But we did so damn well in Africa and Asia and in Europe. It all smooths out. You see, that's the whole point, is that, I mean, yeah, you're going to lose one place, you're going to win another place. That's how you cover risk. So in the world of uncertainty, what we're looking at for people is that there are some of the risks in their lives that can be indemnified. And that's the word, indemnified, I-D-E-M-N-I-F-Y, indemnify. In other words, it basically insure you against risk. But this is not without problems. You see, because, okay, let's start with a couple of the real serious problems. Not everyone wants insurance. And you have to say, how far are we going to be in getting authoritarian with people, forcing them to get insurance, before we no longer have a democracy, a freedom of action? Look, on the side of those who are at risk, and this is car insurance, this is health, I'll focus on health insurance, but the same thing applies to other kinds of insurance as well. One problem that we have is that the problem that those most in need of indemnification are the most likely to seek it. And those least in need are the most likely to seek it. Wait, let me get this down on the board. I'm talking and chewing gum. Okay, those most in need of indemnification are the most likely to seek it, and those least in need of indemnification are the most likely to avoid it. Let me explain what that means and how bad that is. The most likely to avoid it. Let me read it to you again here. Those most in need of indemnification are the most likely to seek it, and those least in need of indemnification are the most likely to avoid it. In other words, people who are more likely to be sick are going to try to get health insurance. Those who think that they won't get sick are going to be the ones who try to stay away from the insurance pools. So in other words, older people are going to be desperate for health insurance. Young people who are healthy are going to avoid it at all if they possibly can. So the risk pool shifts toward those who are probably going to get sick, and we don't have those who are probably not going to get sick. People who plan or have children are going to want health insurance. People who don't want kids, who have no plan to have kids, are going to avoid it. And in fact, they're probably going to say, I'm not going to pay for his snot-nosed kids. You see what happens when that goes on is that you clip off part of the insurance pool. But then, of course, all those people who said, oh, I don't need health insurance, I'm my own man, and all that, well, they go screaming for it when they hit about 40. It just happens. It's the same way with libertarians. They're all tough and butch. But boy, when it comes down to them needing government in their old age, like Ayn Rand did, she was blubbering and screaming and squalling for her government benefits, which is why libertarians make me sick. They should know as much as anyone else that it's all about timing in the risk market. Yeah, you're paying in when you don't need it. That way, you got something when you do need it. Okay? Here's another one. And I was taught about this. You know, I had my finance and my economics background, and I was using a single term, and someone in the insurance industry explained to me that actually there are two terms, but they're used generically as one term. The term that we use, but it actually has two different forms, is moral hazard. Moral hazard. And this insurance person, very well educated, he explained to me, well, actually, there's moral hazard, and then there's morale hazard. He said, most people call them all moral hazard, but he said there really is a distinction. Here's how it works. When you're indemnified, you're more likely to take risks you wouldn't if you weren't indemnified. When you're indemnified, you're more likely to take risks you wouldn't take if you weren't indemnified. Now, here's where the distinction was, and they don't mention this in the book at all, but I'll just bring this up to you in case you go into insurance or you're interested in it. It's hot careers. I mean, money is just flowing in insurance these days, insurance majors. But so I'm telling this to you for that reason and also for a larger reason too. Moral hazard, true moral hazard, is when you deliberately take risks because you know your ass is covered. Morale hazard is when you, just by unconscious action, take risks because you're covered. So let me give you an example. Moral hazard is when you deliberately take risks because you know you're insured or you're covered. Morale hazard is when you unconsciously take risks because you know you're covered. And I'll give you an example. It's a twist on the moral versus morale. Back in the 1950s, something incredibly important in modern advanced nations culture happened. The birth control pill was invented. We called it the pill. Okay, now, moral hazard. You will have unprotected sex because you're not going to get pregnant. You know you are covered, and you do something specifically because you are covered. You wouldn't have done if you weren't covered. Well, you would have done it, but you would have been a lot more careful. Morale hazard. You're also increasing the chances of sexually transmitted diseases that you don't expect to have happen, but it's a consequence of the coverage. But you don't think about that risk that you're still exposed to. You follow the idea? Okay, let me give you another one. Moral hazard. If this one, okay, a moral hazard. You're insured. Your house is insured. You actually have an incentive to burn down your house. Okay. You do. As a matter of fact, interestingly enough, as economic times get worse, the number of house fires increases. Accidental house fires. We know that. Yeah, that's moral hazard. We know damn well people are burning down their damn houses so that they can have some money. Morale hazard, though. If you really were going to lose all your property in a fire, you'd be a hell of a lot more careful about the things that you do in your house that might cause a fire. You'd be more interested in the wiring of your house like we were in the old days. You would be more interested in keeping smoke alarms up and fresh and ready all the time. You wouldn't try to bake that cheeseburger in its aluminum foil in the microwave as we all have at one. No, most of you haven't. I tried it. Don't do it. Okay. You see, there are things that you'll do that you just don't think about. Well, you know, I'm insured. People will drive like blind trout in their cars. Because they're insured. They don't think, well, I'm insured, so if I get creamed and get my ass kicked around a little bit. Actually, it's not that easy. You're actually just not thinking about the carnage that could happen. You're insured. So you're going to do a few things that you probably wouldn't do, but you're not really thinking about the fact that you're doing that. Let me try this. Do you work out every day? Dude, do you even lift? You know, I mean, we all kind of let ourselves slip and all that. Now, the thing is that you're going to be covered by health insurance, so you really don't have to worry about cholesterol, diabetes, heart attacks. They can't happen to you, and besides, even if something does happen to you, you'll have insurance to cover it. But if you knew that it was all going to be on you and you were going to be ruined if you have a heart attack, you were going to be financially destroyed, your life is over, you would probably be a little more careful about how you take care of yourself. But that's just pure morale hazard. You're not really thinking that way. But we know that on aggregate, people do think that way. Let me take you on another one. Not I. Not I. And I'll explain this. This one's not in the book, but it's a very important one. This will not happen to me. Therefore, I don't need to be insured. Otherwise, we call this the Superman syndrome. You're not going to have this happen to you. So you're not going to plan for it. You're not going to put the money away. You're not going to get the high level of insurance coverage that you would need to cover this and to take care of it properly. If I have to buy health care, I'm going to buy the minimum amount because I'm not going to have this happen to you. Imagine the day you have your first heart attack. Have you ever thought about that heart attack? You're grabbing your arm and you're twitching and your back leg is going like this. And then you don't think about that. It's not going to happen to you. It really isn't. It really isn't. You ever had a baby? You thought about it? Thought about labor? Thought about dirty diapers? 5 a day for at least, you know, 12, 18 months, probably 18 months, and maybe in some cases 5 years. You ready for that financial burden? You ever thought about how much money that is? Okay, have you ever thought about the alternative? I'm not going to have kids. And you die alone. No one loves you. Even your husband left you for an ugly old woman. You were uglier than she was. You're not thinking about the future. We don't. That's the problem. And that's one of the reasons that these insurance pools are difficult to maintain because people, even if we force people to have insurance, they're going to get the minimum, especially when they're young. They're going to think, this can't happen to me. I can't get cancer. I can't get diabetes. I can't get cholesterol. I can't have atherosclerosis. I can't have a stroke. I can't get hit by a car in such a way that I am injured terribly. Okay, so that is the people side of it. But the other side of it is the insurance companies, the insurers. They have a dark side too. We'll get to that after the break. Wanted to point out the book does not do the not I, and it does not distinguish moral from moral hazard. Also, I should point out here, by the way, this statement, those most in need of indemnification are most likely to seek it, etc., that's called adverse selection. Adverse selection. Moral hazard is talked about in the book. Don't worry about the part of the book on auctions. We've already gone through auctions. Don't even read that. Moral hazard, morale hazard. The book only mentions moral hazard. So I'm not going to hold you responsible for the concept of morale hazard. It is kind of, it's a little difficult to get around. And the book definitely doesn't mention the not I problem in on the consumer side of insurance. But what I do want to bring up here is the other side of the coin as far as risk goes. Is insurance companies, some of the things that they do that cause some issues, some problems with insurance. One of the classics is what is called, and this is with insurance in the insurers, the indemnifiers, what's called cherry picking. Cherry picking is finding the lowest risk clients and insuring them and keeping the higher risk clients out of your insurance pool. That's cherry picking. So you'll see that there are these places, these advertisements on TV. If you've had a clean driving record for the past 5 years, we want to insure you. That's cherry picking. What they're doing is they are simply looking for those kinds of clients that would have low risk. And then they leave the higher risk clients to all essentially pool in other insurance companies. And ultimately, cherry picking leads to all kinds of other problems. One interesting thing is that you'll have cherry pickers will take the best, the lowest risk people, like for car insurance. And then what they'll do is they'll leave everyone else to other pools. And then those other pools will find their ways to cherry pick on their clients. So that eventually you'll have at least three tiers of the market. You'll have the cherry picker companies insuring the best. Then you'll have the mid-range companies insuring sort of like middle risk. And then you'll have what are called the substandard insurers who will insure just high-risk clients. Among those would be, for example, Progressive Insurance. Now, that doesn't mean the Progressive would not try to get better clients. They advertise on TV all the time. They act like they're not a substandard insurer, but they are. But what they're trying to do is always get a few good risks into their pool at any given time, just so they can counterbalance some of the phenomenal risk they take with the substandard pool that's their bread and butter. The problem with cherry picking has always been with us. But then there's an opposite problem here I'm going off the track of the textbook somewhat. It's a risk payout spiral. I'm going to give you a real live example of a risk payout spiral. Many years ago, there was a company around. I was insured by this company, as were several of my brothers and a number of my fellow professionals. It was called Educators and Executives Insurance. Nothing but a pure cherry picker company. It insured only educators and executives, which by their nature are very low risk. They don't have car accidents. They don't even get tickets. We are the most boring human beings on earth. We also tend not to have, as far as health insurance problems go, we tend to have longer lives. God knows why, with people like you to teach. But we're talking about the auto insurance, property and casualty. Okay, educators and executives with a cherry picker made buku money because its insurance premiums were low, but its payouts were incredibly low. So it was like a wonderful company to be a part of, to be insured by, and it was also a wonderful company to own. Well, back in the day, in the 1980s and 90s, there were all these companies out there in different industries, retail industries, that were making huge amounts of money, and they were just using that money to buy up other companies. They thought, well, we were so successful in what we did, we'll just buy companies in something completely unrelated to what we did because, hey, we're geniuses. One of those companies was JCPenney, which in that time was quite successful as a retailer, been around for a long time. And so they bought Educators and Executives Insurance. And the first thing they did was apply retail business model to it. You always want to increase your sales. The faster your sales increase, the better off you are. So, how do you increase sales in insurance? You get more insureds. How do you get more insureds? By taking on people who aren't quite as low risk. So, what had been Educators and Executives was JCPenney Insurance. And JCPenney Insurance, doing what a retailer would do, started to advertise. Educators and Executives didn't advertise. They didn't need to. You were an educator or an executive. You got a little thing in the mail, or your friends were all in the E&E. But JCPenney advertised. And, of course, in came the people wanting insurance. Well, that's great. More premiums coming in the door. Sales went through the roof. But then, with the higher risk clients, they started maybe 6 months, a year later, their payout ratio started going up. Well, I'll be darned, we're insuring riskier people. They're hitting us up on claims more and more. Okay, well, how do we get our revenues up so that we can pay all these payout claims? We sell more policies, which means you have to take on more risky people. We can do it. So they took on more risky people. Premiums went through the roof again. But then those riskier people started having even worse claims payouts. And so suddenly payouts were overrunning revenue. So what did JCPenney do again? They did what a retailer would do. They sold more policies to even riskier people. And of course, ultimately, JCPenney Insurance went to hell. It was an amazing story. The risk payout spiral. You start trying to do what seems like obvious, get more sales, more premiums in the door. Well, when you do that, the market is already saturated. The great people aren't going to go and see an ad on TV and call for insurance. They're not going to do it. The only people who are going to go for that are the people who need insurance, and those most in need of indemnification are going to seek it. That's adverse selection. Spank me, Jesus. They got themselves into a problem, and the problem turned into something we call bankruptcy. That's risk payout spiral. Okay, well, now there are other problems, too. Redlining. Redlining is somewhat similar to cherry picking, but it's not. It's only on the surface. Now, the term redlining comes from one of my specialties, real estate, finance. Well, real estate. One of my field specializations was real estate and urban studies. This is old school in real estate. I'll tell you how it worked. Back in the day, you literally, as a real estate agent, had maps of your city. And on those maps were red lines. They actually weren't red lines. They were red figures marking streets this way and that way around neighborhoods. The red lines were to designate what were the undesirable neighborhoods for white people to move to, and what were the desirable neighborhoods for the quote-unquote colored people to move to. That was how it worked. It was practiced openly. Even back in my time, I saw red line maps. Back when I was in my PhD studies, we had one of my great professors. He brought in a bunch of maps. He collected them from real estate agents he knew, and he showed them to us. And I thought, well, I'll be damned. You can't do that. And he said, oh, yes, you can. It was only after lawsuits and laws were passed that redlining was banned. But it really never was. A friend of mine, a real estate agent here in town, successful, he said, here's how we do it these days. I got a nice couple in their late 20s. They're white. And they say, we saw a house listed. We think this is really pretty, the pictures and the description, just what we want. He said, well, what I'll do is I'll take them in my car. And I won't go to that house. I'll drive around the neighborhood. Make sure that I drive around the neighborhood in the later afternoon after school's out, so that they can see the color of the kids playing. And I'll just keep driving them around until I can tell that they're ready to see another house because they don't want to live in that neighborhood because of the racial composition. Redlining is still alive and well. You just don't draw it on a damn map that could be used as evidence in a court case. Okay, redlining in insurance is similar to the extent that what you do is you just simply don't insure certain kinds of people. One insurance company, it was caught red-handed doing it, if you'll forgive the red term in there. And in fact, it is not illegal. I was a little surprised by this because I thought there's got to be laws that prevent this. It will not insure any black male over the age of 35, health insurance. Won't insure them. Why? Because they have a higher chance of having heart attacks, hypertension and heart attacks. So watch yourself. I'm not going to be, if you die, you know, I'm going to be away from you. But in fact, they will insure black females. And in fact, interestingly enough, they'll insure enough more black females so that their overall black percentage mirrors the community, so that they're not in violation of any discrimination law. We insure exactly as many blacks as we're supposed to. It's just that they will not insure the ones who would get the high payouts. Similarly, you will find that insurance companies are just busting their asses right now behind the scenes in Washington to make it so that it will not be illegal for them to do genetic screening before they insure people. That is the great danger of giving up your DNA, because if an insurance company gets a hold of it, they will be able to assess with very high probability not only that you might get a cancer, but actually about when you'll get it. Risk factors, they're going to look at that DNA for risk factors on every different angle, from mental illnesses to birth defects in children that they will bear to their incidences of all kinds of cancers. They want to take redlining to a level that it has not even gotten to yet. So within the next 10 years, they're going to make sure that there are no laws that prevent them from doing it, and they're going to start genetically screening for insurance. That's where the story is going at this point. That should scare the hell out of you that that's where it's going to go. Because you can't control this, for God's sake. And in fact, this violates the whole point of what I showed you before. Yes, we all have risk factors, and they cancel each other out, for heaven's sakes. At different times, different people will get sick with different things, and we let that happen. That's the whole point. Trying to sneak a peek behind the coin toss is not just cheating, it's just stupid. But here's the last one on this side of it. It's what's called and I call it this. This one's definitely not the textbook. And I've got a wonderful example. Unintended risk mitigation consequences. Look, in the world of insurance, the job is not always just to insure, but it's also to mitigate risks. Well, in personal insurance, there's nothing wrong with an insurance company telling you, look, we would really like you not to eat so much cholesterol-laden food. We'd really like you to lay off the smoking. It's not that we're trying to cheat or anything. We just want you to not do things that are stupid risks. The same, by the way, is true with commercial insurance, much more. I mean, you'll have insurance companies. When I take my students to get jobs in the insurance industry, I'm not taking them to get jobs in sales. I'm taking them to get jobs in risk analysis, risk management, risk control, loss control. In other words, these guys are going to learn how to assess the risks of the companies and figure out what a good premium is for them. They're also going to tell companies, look, you see that? That's a risk. We don't want to insure that. So why don't you not do that anymore? That's part of the job. It's telling people, you know, don't do things. Or telling companies, don't do this. I had a funny example. A great, good friend of mine was risk manager at a major, huge insurance company that managed insurance for big corporations and things like that. One of these corporations called her one day, one of the big wigs there, said, okay, we've got a chance to get involved. We've been doing government contracts, and the government contract we're in has an extension where we could get into the development, testing, and manufacture of firearms, a certain type of military weapon, way outside of what they'd done before for the government, but it was sort of in the same league. They built equipment for military operations and all that, and they were given a chance. You can build the weapons that are going to be mounted, some of the guns that are going to be mounted on these vehicles. And he said, so what do you think of this? And she said, what I think of this? You're not going to do it. What? No, you're not going to do it. Well, this is our decision. Well, yeah, if it's your decision, it's your decision, but you're not going to have insurance from us. And wherever you find insurance, it's going to cost you more than anything you could possibly make off this contract. End of story. They will do that. Great example right now is all of these laws that are making open carry of firearms okay. The insurance companies are simply telling these companies, you're not going to have firearms in your building. You're going to put stickers on the door, and if you don't put those stickers on the door and enforce no firearms policy, we're going to cut off your insurance. Not only your insurance, but your workers' comp, everything. It's gone. So that's why you see all these stickers popping up all over the place. Out here, it's kind of funny because you got all these big gun nuts out here. We want our firearms. We want to walk around Walmart with a gun in our hand. The insurance companies are saying, you let people in the door with those kinds of firearms, you let your workers walk around with those kinds of firearms all day, you're not going to have our insurance. That's all there is to it. So a lot of times insurance companies will try to mitigate risks and mitigate loss. Here's an example where it goes wrong. Years and years, there was a positive externality from wearing seatbelts. In fact, the positive externality was so high that it was a merit good. The government went as far as propaganda. Buckle up for safety. Everyone buckle up. Pull your seatbelt snug. Give it an extra hug. Pull your seatbelt up. Buckle up. Propaganda. Well, then, interestingly enough, the laws, some states began to get around to passing mandatory seatbelt laws. It wasn't very popular at all. Most people didn't wear seatbelts. I mean, you just didn't. But, you know, well, obviously the government cares. No. That was pushed by the insurance industry because wearing a seatbelt meant that there was less loss of life, less injury, and car accident. So they were the ones who got those seatbelt laws passed. But they were not enforced, and they were weak, and there were very few states that went that route. But then something interesting happened starting in the early 1990s. A new technology for cars was invented, airbags. Airbags could be put into cars, but they were expensive to put in. Now, what the auto insurance did, auto manufacturers did was this. They said, okay, airbags can be an option, but we're sure not going to put them on every car because they're going to increase the price of a car by anywhere from $500 to $1,500, putting an airbag in a car. It's just, we're not going to do it. We're going to lose sales. People are just going to hold on to their cars that don't have airbags. They're not going to do this. And then the insurance industry stepped in because they knew that those airbags were going to reduce fatalities and accidents. And they put huge money into state legislatures and into the federal legislature. At the federal level, they put enough money into the pockets of congressmen that finally mandatory airbags in cars were the law of the land. The auto manufacturers had to put them in. Risk mitigation. Insurance company didn't want to pay out those death benefits. They knew airbags were going to save lives. But unfortunately, here's where the unintended consequence comes in. Airbags save lives, but in fact, it costs the insurance companies much, much more at the end of the day, because an airbag will keep a person from dying because it will prevent thoracic and face damage. But what it won't do is protect the lower pelvic and leg area. So instead of paying out a $50,000 death benefit for a car accident, fatal car accident, insurance companies were paying out $250,000, $500,000, $750,000 for rehabilitation of a person who had lived through an accident but had had his legs and ass mangled. The insurance industry had an unintended consequence. Mandatory airbags in cars force the auto industry to put these expensive things in the cars. That'll save us money. No, it actually cost a fortune. The payouts went out through the roof because people were living through accidents and they were having to be put back together again in incredibly expensive ways. So, what happened? Then the insurance company industry steps back around and they start making sure that state legislatures mandated seat belts. Click it or ticket. That's not for your safety. It's because the insurance industry realized all along seat belts and the shoulder harness are the way you keep people from getting killed in accidents and getting severely injured. The airbags are important to keep the thorax from getting damaged. But the real payoff, the insurance industry, it cost them a lot of money because a lot of legislators said, you know, all this years, these years ago, you were bitching at us. You were making the federal government require the auto companies to put these big airbags in cars and all that kind of stuff. Now you're coming around telling us it was the seatbelt you wanted? Well, yeah, here's some money. Okay. Unintended consequences. By the way, did you know that story, the click it or ticket? Yeah, you ever seen that? And they even stand the creeps on the at the corners and the guy will look in your car to see if you're wearing your seatbelt these days. It has nothing to do with your safety. It has to do everything to do with making sure that the insurance companies don't have to pay out huge claims to put people back together again because they lived through the accident because of the airbag, but they got their lower half torn to shreds. So unintended risk mitigation consequences are something on the insurance industry side, and they'll just keep bringing it back around to your side with something new all the time. Now the big thing is that they're going to mandate more airbags because it seems that airbags that stop your body from hitting the thing, they save your life, but there's something that airbags, front airbags and the seatbelts don't stop. The one that they've still got that's hanging out there is that in any kind of a collision where there is any kind of a side force, your head's going to hit. And then you're going to be saying, go Cubbies for the rest of your life. Or go Cardinals. That was evil. Because you're going to be brain damaged. So now the big one is the side curtains that will just drop down on the sides so that when you bang your head, it won't really make you stupid. It'll just make it so that it takes you maybe another year to get through Heartland Community College. That's all I have for you tonight. Go home.